The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Reason for Faith Festival. My name is Peter Caldor. Wonderful to have you here. We're here today to discuss the question, can we be good with God? And our two spokespeople will be Chris Berg and Dr. Greg Clark. Can I please ask you to welcome them as they come up? Perhaps Chris sit there and Greg here.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Chris is a research fellow with the Institute of Public Affairs and a columnist with the Sunday Age. And Greg is the CEO of the newly amalgamated Bible Society of Australia. I should point out that you will have opportunity to participate today through SMS questions. You can see hopefully the number between the two gentlemen. Those questions or comments, please keep brief. They'll be passed through to my handsome assistant here, Robert, and he'll pass them through to me and I'll do my best to integrate them into the conversation. Well, Christopher Hitchens, the recently deceased author and journalist, wrote a quite famous book, God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. And in this book, he not only points out that we can be good without God, but that actually religion, Christianity included, can be a source of immorality, of evil. So hence the question today, can we be good with God? Now, gentlemen, there's been a lot said from both sides of the camps, both atheism and Christianity, as to who's done perhaps more evil. Can I start, Chris? What do you make of these arguments that have been floating around?
As some of you may have known, I wrote a column in the Sunday Age just last weekend covering off some of these and trying to make... I'm an atheist, trying to make an atheist case for Christianity. And one of the issues that I wanted to raise specifically is this argument, you know, which side has done more harm than the other side? Now, I find this one of the most pointless and least informing arguments that we could have. Does it matter if Adolf Hitler was a Christian or an atheist? Can anybody find any implication that the answer to that question would have for the truth or otherwise of religious belief? People have done great harm throughout history. There's absolutely no question. Many of those were Christians. Many of those were people professing to act on Christianity's behalf. And likewise on the other side as well, this tedious tit-for-tat who killed more than who doesn't help us understand whether we can have a modern society that has a modern sense of morality with or without God. It doesn't teach us anything about the reality of religious claims, of which I've got many views, and I just find it really, really unhelpful. And the problem with, and I'm a big Christopher Hitchens fan in general, but the problem with Christopher Hitchens' argument is he wants to prove too much. Not only does he want to prove that God doesn't exist, which I agree with, but he also wants to prove not only does God not exist, but people who believe in God have done great wrongs. Those two are mutually exclusive claims. They don't have to go together, and they don't have to inform how we understand religion in the 21st century.
Okay, thank you, Chris. Greg, I think Chris has made the argument that there doesn't necessarily need to be a connection between evil behaviour, perhaps on the part of a Christian person, arguably, say, Hitler, if he were Christian. Do you agree with that?
I don't agree with the view that Hitler was Christian. But I think I'm presumably on board with you in what you said there. I mean, there is too much of this kind of who is worse than the other discussion going on. It's all about point scoring from one side to the other, and it really is fruitless. From the Christian perspective, I'm disappointed at any wrongdoing by myself or anyone else. That's the starting point, actually, that we're disappointed and regret wickedness and evil from the outset. And wherever it is found, want to correct it and want to make a difference to the world. That's the Christian way. But for me, the flip side is a much more interesting question. Is can you look at the relative input to the world from the various religious traditions, from the atheist traditions, and assess how much we gain from those different traditions. Like, that's a very interesting area that we should probably explore more.
And I think, Chris, you did pick up on that in the article you wrote on Sunday.
Yeah, so my the way I came to this argument, and I'm sure it's available on the internet if you have a look, if you have no idea what I'm talking about. The way I came to this argument is that I'm very interested in political philosophy, and particularly, although not exclusively, John Locke, the great 17th century liberal. And his arguments for liberalism, as you read them in the original, you realise that he's mounting an argument for liberalism, which I would consider a secular argument, but he is mounting it within explicitly Christian terms. He is debating his fellow Englishmen, talking about biblical passages. He is creating what he believes is is the sort of political environment or political state that God wanted within specifically Christian precepts, and mounting arguments that I agree with the separation of church and state. I think all modern small-L liberals believe that church and state should be separated. Now, that is, in his view, and in the views of great thinkers throughout history, they came to that through Christian arguments, and we can trace those as early as Jesus' command that give to Caesar what is Caesar's, etc., etc.
So what other things would you just quickly list off as being, I guess, the heritage from the Christian faith?
One of the big concepts that I think we view as secular now, but has deeply Christian roots that have defined how we understand it today, is the concept of human or individual rights. The concept of natural rights was formulated in a Christian context. Rights are given to you by God. We've secularized that idea. We've said that, you know, rather than they are naturally given, it is correct that we all have the same equal human rights or individual rights. But my argument is you wouldn't have the concept of human rights and individual rights in the shape we have it today if it hadn't been for Christian thinkers. Now, if we didn't have Christianity, if Christianity had not become the official religion of the Roman Empire, we might have had another concept of rights. We may have had a similar concept of rights, but it wouldn't have been the same. And you can't distinguish, you can't take away its Christian origins from its contemporary shape.
Well, Greg, so far Chris has been arguing very cogently.
Very, very refreshing.
We'll try to find something that we...
Right.
I'm sure we will. I'm sure we will.
I think it's wonderful, because what we're hearing here is an acknowledgement that won't be made by many of the mainstream atheists. You're mainstream, but the writers...
I'm writers, down underground.
...that are making more money than he is at the moment by publishing their books. Because it's a little bit ridiculous sometimes looking at the falling over backwards that atheists are doing to try and claim that this Christianity made no difference to the society, made no difference to the shape of our politics. I mean, the human rights one is a wonderful example of how the rights discussion does take you right back into the Hebrew Bible, actually, and then into Christianity, in my understanding of it. But when it comes into the modern era, and we have the United Nations and the discussion around the human rights charter, the bill, it's fascinating to see that if any worldview had an impact on the shaping of that UN activity, it's the Christian worldview. And even though most of the people involved in this discussion, as far as I understand, were not themselves Christians, there were some significant Christian players there, but even so, they agreed on the Christian worldview as the basis for the development of the human rights that we now enjoy. So, but my question, I guess, to try and create some tension there with Chris, is that it's a little bit of a free ride for the moment in secular society to have benefited from these outworkings of the Christian viewpoint to the point where we can turn back on them. It's like the child who's had such a lovely, enjoyable upbringing, and parents have been so good to you, and they've given you all these great things, to the point where they can cope with you kind of turning back and slapping them and saying, we're not interested in that anymore, we've got what we want from you. And I feel we're at an interesting point in society at the moment where there's some rejection of the Christian Christian history and Christian metaphysics, but wanting to keep on board the benefits that Christianity has given to the society. I guess I want to challenge that and say, look, if it looks like a duck and you like the taste of duck and it sounds like a duck, well, maybe it really is a duck that you're enjoying, and we really need to look back and see what Christian truths have informed these good things that we now enjoy.
Well, saying it's a free ride is actually, I think, really unfair to atheism, because, or it's actually unfair to Christianity, because the atheism that we have is overwhelmingly, when we discuss this, it's a Christian atheism. I was brought up a Christian. I wasn't a particularly strong believer as a child, but you were brought up in this moral and ethical framework that informs our political and legal system and so forth. The atheism that Christians now find so frustrating is a outworking of that original Christianity. It is the heir to some of the best elements in Christianity, and a rejection of some of the worst. So some of the best elements is the emphasis on reason. Now, I'm pleased that this is reason through faith, because intellect, as an area of intellectual history, the concept of reason informing your faith goes back to early medieval, late antiquity. And Christians are just going to have to deal with the fact that people have reasoned away from those original precepts while still being able to take credit for its historical origins.
Yeah, so a few people have reasoned away. There are many who are still happily reasoning towards.
Oh, absolutely. So in my article in the section where I said I'm an atheist, I pointed out that in my view that Christianity is historically unsubstantiated and scientifically unnecessary. And you come to those conclusions from the very reason that Christianity has helped build.
Yes, well, I mean, obviously I disagree with both of those claims. The article. I thought the article was very brave, though, because the voices of atheism are so shrill. It was lovely to hear someone actually acknowledging things and still being comfortable in your atheist skin.
We can go to shrill if you like.
I can't turn it on. But, I mean, those two claims, just quickly to come back, and this is not necessarily meant to be an apologetics kind of session on them, but the claim that Christian history is unsubstantiated is entirely unsubstantiated. In fact, even among the historical Jesus scholars of our time, regardless of their religious faith, the mainstream are completely committed to, one, that Jesus existed, yep. Two, that he had a reputation as a healer,
yep.
Three, that he had a band of followers that built on his ethical teachings, that challenged some of the Jewish thinking and renewed a lot of it. Four, that he died. He died a death, yep. On the cross. and five, that something else happened after that shaped the direction of the development of not only the Middle East but the Western world, something that is very hard to understand given our current historical information on it. That's the kind of general shape of a mainstream historian who isn't even a believer. Now, a believer has no trouble then saying, I can believe that Jesus rose from the dead because God raised him from the dead. So I think that there's a lot of... In fact, this is the area that the new atheists have avoided assiduously. Whenever the topic of Jesus comes up, it's dismissed without any reference to the key scholars on the subject, with the possible exception of Bart Ehrman. Most of the time, it's just dismissed as if it was possible to think Jesus never existed. There really isn't a single professor of ancient history in the world who thinks Jesus didn't exist.
There's no reason, historically, using the evidence we have, to suggest that Jesus didn't exist. There's more than enough evidence to suggest that he was crucified, or at least killed in some year, a few years before his followers went out, basically. And that is unquestionable. And I don't think that there are serious new atheists who are trying to revise the Jesus Jordan doesn't exist.
Hitchens,
the Jesus doesn't exist crowd do not make that argument. Not mainstream, I should say.
Except for Dawkins.
Does Dawkins say that he does not exist? Because there's no reason.
There's a case that can be made that Jesus doesn't exist.
Yeah,
I would go with your approach.
That's bad. you don't have a Christianity unless you've got the spectacular rising from the dead. You just don't have it. You've got another itinerant preacher in the Middle East.
Paul says as much. That is the heart of
And that is much more challenging to prove, and I don't think that we have the historical evidence to suggest that it occurred, or at least not sufficiently. I mean, extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. You don't have substantial enough evidence to suggest that's the case. Without that, you've got to look at, do we need it for science, or have you had a personal experience? I don't think you need it for science. I haven't had a personal experience. I don't see any reason to be Christian.
I think we do have the kind of evidence you would expect that took place. That is, you have records around of the events themselves, around the time, with the kind of shape to them of people who were dealing with a miraculous event, who were surprised by this themselves. It wasn't that they had resurrections happen every day. And so the kind of record of the risen Jesus is exactly what you'd expect to see. Plus we have the argumentation of the logic of history. There was an empty tomb, which is an historically establishable fact. And all the documentation suggests that there was an empty tomb where Jesus did once lay. Then you can work your way through whether the disciples stole the body and all the arguments about that. There are answers here. And then the appearance stories, which are listed in the Gospels, that Jesus appeared after death, which likewise can be examined historically and I believe have some strength to them. And then the third part of that is the rise of the church. Within a very short period of time, this movement arose that is now accounts for a third of the world's population, 2 billion people, from this tiny event in this corner of the Roman Empire, with these people who were not equipped to do the mission that they set out to do. So something happened around that time that's unusual. And to me, the best explanation of it, rationally using the logic of history, is that Jesus rose from the dead. So I guess we've got an impasse there.
Yeah, of course.
Another science one, because I think that's really worth lingering on, and this is where, you know, I have a huge respect for Dawkins in particular, because this is his field. But it seems to me that they really do tip over into claiming too much knowledge about the basis of science. That for science to work, there are a certain number of things that I think you need to be in place, which you can't be sure are in place within evolutionary naturalism. You really can't be sure that your beliefs will match the world within the evolutionary hypothesis. It'll be almost accidental if they do, if you can actually make sense of the world out there. There is no reason to think that we should have brains that can make sense of the world out there, and yet we do. The Christian teaching that man is in some way fallen also indicates to me the need for science, and that science works because of this thesis of human frailty that you have in Christianity. And this is not my argument, this is Peter Harrison from Oxford University. The concept that humans are frail and fallen and their reason has limits, like Locke says, leads us to science, because science gives you the methodology to account for your own frailty. Now, right at the bedrock of science are at least two pillars there of Christian thinking. One, the frailty of humanity and the need for correction based on our faulty understanding. And secondly, the need for a mind, an intelligence, a unifying, ordering being or principle in order that science would work and that you can explain why your mind can make sense of the universe. So
these are universal ethical prohibitions that came well before Christianity. I mean, the concept of skepticism about the world, the concept that we don't understand all of reality. I mean, we don't understand, that's Plato's cave metaphor as much as anything else. Sort of Roman sense of skepticism and all that sort of thing. So I don't think that we should overcook. So all we're left is your argument that science requires a religion of some description and an empty tomb, and that is Christianity. And I can't believe that the specific foundations of Christianity, built in political circumstances, defined in councils that were to support Roman emperors against alternative interpretations. I mean, you know, what if Arianism is correct? I mean, it was kicked out. Constantine kicked Arius, exiled Arius out of the Roman Empire.
Well, they reasoned from the scriptures, so that process of reasoning.
But, I mean, they lost. And what if the political circumstance, and I don't think we should discount Roman era politics, has defined what we understand now as Christianity and taken us away from whatever central truth, you know, the earliest gospel suggests, as opposed to later gospels, which give different impressions. But
sure, we don't get all Da Vinci Code about it, because a lot of the discussion of the early history is just all over the shop at the moment. And there's a much more natural kind of arising of the Christian church from the documents of the scriptures that is sometimes told, and Dan Brown has a lot to face.
I haven't read Dan Brown, but the idea that a political grouping suddenly came to the truth, I find really historically dubious.
And that's not how it happened. So
you might remind it. Anyway, let's draw a line in the sand at that point. That's been fascinating so far. Let's return a little bit more directly to the question of can we be good with God. There have been a few questions along that vein, and I'll sort of feed them in a moment. But perhaps before we get really into that, could we first just reflect for a moment, what does it mean to be good? Chris?
There's a basic intuition that we all have about what constitutes a moral good. The title of this session is odd because it sort of seems stacked in my favour.
That was deliberate.
And I think as this was originally mentioned to me, it was, can we be good without God? Which sort of, like, oh, okay, I don't know what's going on now. Can we be good without God, though, seems to be a much more interesting or much more pointed.
It's picking up the Hitchens critique.
Yeah, sure. So if you don't mind, I'll just address the without God question very briefly. And as an atheist, I think that obviously we can be good without God because there is no God and you've got all these people being good without. And you've got atheists who are good, definitionally. You will know that's the case. If you think I'm bad, well, I'm deeply offended. Definitionally answers itself. The alternative interpretation is that we need God to create a, you know, framework around. We need a belief in God, I should say, to create a framework that tells us what we can and can't do. And I think that's a sort of weird moral utilitarianism that does no one end.
So are we, if just so I understand, perhaps the audience, are we saying that the concept of good is a given?
The concept of good is an intuitive sense that we all have.
Okay.
And the reason why ethical debates are so complicated is because that intuition doesn't work in every circumstance, and there are competing intuitions. But there are really basic ones, like do not kill. That is a really obvious one. That breaks down in the case of wartime, or if someone is attacking your family, and so on and so forth. And we all know these intuitions within us, and we can debate how they play out in certain moral circumstances. But we all have it. It's just an innate human thing that religious and non-religious people have.
Okay, great. What about you? How would you see the meaning of good?
Okay, I think I'd say, can we be good without God? Yes, we can. But we'll really struggle to explain why we should be.
Explain to you why, like, if you don't know why you shouldn't torture someone, then what answer, or like, what explanation is going to convince you that I shouldn't torture someone? No, I mean, to
reasonably are, I guess.
No, but if you don't know that murdering an innocent person is a bad thing, then no religious, philosophical debate is ever going to convince you of that.
What about caring for the disabled? See, some things I agree with you, there's a general morality there, but other things seem to require more reflection, direction, and so forth. But across cultures in history and different nations today, it's not commonly agreed you should care for the disabled. There are differences. Some people leave the disabled because they think they're cursed for one reason or another. To take Peter Singer, for example, there are limits to the kind of disability that you'll care for. Now, these are big, big calls in the moral realm.
Yeah.
And to me, you can only answer the why question about those when you start to refer back to your metaphysics or to your theology. You say, well, I care for the disabled because I believe that all humans are created in the image of God, seen in the same light by God, and deserve respect. And, in fact, they deserve wasteful care, because that's how God has wasted care and love on us. So there are some moral issues where it seems to make sense like that. There are others that need to be teased out. Even the God delusion in Dawkins' book, it really fascinated me that he lists out morality as if everyone will just accept it. And a couple of the things that he mentions as things that everyone will accept were quite standouts to me. One was to do with sexuality, that everyone can just have whatever sexual behaviours they would like, as long as it's not hurting anyone else. I think there'd be great debate about whether everyone does agree on that. And the other one was to do with species, that all species should be treated equally as much as possible. But that is a very new thought
in
human culture, that all species should be treated equally. And we're going to have to really wrestle with that to say, what's the basis of that instinct? But he put it forward as if we'd all just accept it.
Yeah.
So I think we've got to wrestle with the definition a bit more.
The sexuality one, I, as a libertarian, I agree. If you're not doing anybody else any harm, it's all voluntary, then who cares? The species is, I am surprised that you wouldn't back that, because I don't think our basic intuition leads us into that circumstance. Mm. Should ants be treated the same as human beings, and should you feel as guilty for stepping on an ant as you would for killing another human being? Mm. I don't think our intuition leads us into that direction. But you could, if he reasons his way to that, so from agreed moral precepts like you shall not kill, therefore you shall not kill an ant, then you know, we can have that debate. But I'm not convinced that reference to religious precepts provides any guide on either of those questions anyway. So the challenge is not so much, does the intuition model of to build a moral framework, does that fix every moral question? The challenge is, does it fix more moral questions, or does it answer more moral questions than any alternative theory, from utilitarianism to scripture? And I would say that the intuition model actually provides a way that we can come to conclusions about this, with the added benefit that it's true. We all have these intuitions.
Do you feel the intuition is universal and uncorrupted?
Is that... It's not universal insofar as, you know, extremely young children don't have those same intuitions. Mm. You know, you have to grow into that basic intuition.
Mm. Because the sexual intuition, for example, of different cultures are quite different. Some will perhaps accept polygamy, but not homosexuality, to quote some of the African nations at the moment. So how would you make a decision?
Yeah, there are differences of opinion, obviously, on this, which is why they are challenging moral questions. Mm. Now, I don't think that sexuality...
It's not just intuition.
No. There are competing intuitions, and then you reason together to at least find a workable solution. Now, I don't think the sexuality question is a challenging question at all, but I recognise, of course, that historically it has been. But that's a very Hitchens argument that you've mounted. I mean, for example, some people think that disabled people are cursed. That is, you know, God has done terrible things then, or at least religious belief have done terrible things to impose that value on them.
So, Chris, at this point, there is a question directly here from the audience. What within atheism would stop me from doing evil to achieve a greater good? Is it ultimately an appeal to reason? Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, there are lots of different atheist moral philosophies, and the problem with this debate is that we're setting up a Christian and an atheist. There are Christian, there's a one Christian view and there's one atheist view. That's obviously not the case. Mm. Once you start working through metaphysical and moral philosophies that don't reference a supernatural power, then there's lots of different things. And I would say that I'm not a utilitarian. I think that's a close to foul philosophy, because it does start making, you know, if you can kill one baby and save one baby but give another baby a toy, you should do it. No, and that's a utilitarian argument there. And everybody says that's obviously absurd, because they've got this basic moral intuition that says, no, that's wrong, you can't just randomly start killing babies so that other babies get toys. I think that's a bit of an absurd sort of juxtaposition, or an absurd dichotomy. The reason that you wouldn't do awful things for a greater good is because you would, you know, figure out whether it's a right thing to do or not. And you don't need to read the Bible to find that out. You don't need to believe that there was an empty tomb to find that out. You know it. And I think to pretend that Christians don't have that basic intuition as much as anybody else is to give Christians a huge disservice.
Can I shift it a little bit there? Just because the other side of this is to look at what are the consequences of moral failings in the atheistic worldview and the Christian worlview. The two are sort of putting it together. And it seems to me, in the Christian worldview, it's clear that sin takes you away from a holy God, but you can be forgiven because Jesus Christ died for your sins. So the sin can be relieved, the punishment can be relieved, You can be in good relationship with God, at peace, and so forth. There's a model there for dealing with moral failings. But you're promoting a moral, almost universal kind of morality, but how do you deal with moral failings within the atheist framework?
I don't think I'm promoting it. I think I'm describing something that exists. And I find the idea that we wouldn't sin because otherwise we'd be punished. You shouldn't sin because otherwise you'll go to hell, or God will be furious, or have to pay penance.
That's only one motivation. You do it because it's better not to as well. But that's not
okay. Yeah, sure. But I don't find that a particularly stable moral defence either. So you ask God for forgiveness after a great moral wrong. You are not absolved in my eyes for asking God for forgiveness if you've done a great moral wrong. I mean, you've done a great moral wrong, and you haven't you haven't asked the victim for forgiveness. You've asked God for forgiveness. You've asked a what I consider to be a fictional construct for forgiveness, having done something really, really terrible. So I don't find that a particularly convincing defence of way to recompense for moral wrongs. And you're left no better than I am if you accept my reasoning there. You've done something immoral, and the attack to that is social ostracization. It's other human beings and your own sense of guilt.
So can you achieve justice within the atheist worldview or not?
Well, yeah, you can, but there's two kinds of justice here. We're obviously there are two moral wrongs, and some moral wrongs are punished by the law, and others are sort of social wrongs that are nevertheless legal. And the justice can be achieved by both ends. So some things are so morally wrong that we make them illegal, like killing. Other things are morally wrong, but we allow it. Racism. At least until the Racial Discrimination Act. Bad thoughts, hateful feelings are moral wrongs, but we don't punish that by sending someone to jail. We punish that through social ostracization, through society's moral oppression, which we shouldn't discount. But again, if you're an atheist, there's not really much competition between your and my views, just you've got an extra thing that's not true, and we're operating in the same world.
But if you do believe in God, and you do believe in some sort of moral objectivity, then it's entirely different.
But there is a moral objectivity in this as well. In fact, there's moral objectivities in most moral philosophies that many atheists will have, not all, but most. The challenge is to find that objective view, and as in the differences of thought within Christian communities, there's no particularly objective view about many moral questions anyway. On sexuality, for example, there are churches that are firmly opposed to homosexuality, there are churches that don't care about homosexuality. There will be Christian communities that do think that every species is of equal value and equal moral worth, and many that don't. So I don't think that the challenge when you have these debates is not to find a moral solution that solves every single question. It's to find one that perhaps solves more.
Yeah, sure. So I think if, to summarise perhaps briefly, we've perhaps established that Greg is appealing to some higher order as a basis for the good, and you're appealing to some common intuition and reason. Perhaps moving from the basis, looking forward, what are your hopes and wishes and longings in life, individually and as a society? What is the good life that you aspire to? Perhaps both, a few quick comments.
This is a big question. Where do you see yourself in 5 years?
I think as a Christian, what you strive to do is to walk in the Master's footsteps, is to follow Christ. And so my hopes and aspirations are that I'll be more Christ-like. Now, that actually is really significant because it means I define good quite particularly. So, and this is my struggle with the idea of these universal goodnesses, because things like laying down your life for another person, in the Christian worldview, either metaphorically or literally, that is a good to be pursued, not in any kind of bizarre masochistic way, but in a way whenever there's the opportunity to put yourself out for others, that you would actually pursue that as the good life. That's what Jesus did, that's what his disciples did, that's what he encourages us to do, is to think of others instead of ourselves. So that's that I think is quite a specifically Christian teaching that's taken on in broader society, which is really lovely. So it's the teachings of Jesus that inform my longings, and it's becoming more like Christ that shapes what the good life is for me.
Okay.
My longings for the world. I hope that as many people have the capacity to flourish, to find their own places, to find their own views. This comes back to the sort of thing I write about and I do as a job, talking about political philosophy. My idea of the good life is allow people a world where we can allow people to find whatever meaning that might be. If that meaning is in Christianity, if that meaning is in atheism, I don't care as long as you're happy. I mean, as long as you're finding a position and respecting the rights of others to have that. Have and hold that position. Human flourishing can be as much an atheist.
That's a good thing, but it seems you've surrendered reason in that process. Because if everyone can happily end up wherever they'd like to, surely you would hope they would have a reasoned faith, if they're going to have a faith, or have a reasoned atheism.
I hope that a lot of people think deeply about their own philosophical and religious views, but I'm under no assumption that most people will. I mean, I hope that most people spend their life pursuing their own interests, not necessarily spending all their time debating, you know, why shouldn't I murder someone? Like, why, you know, should I be homosexual?
It's fine for you in a Christianized culture like this, though, because these questions are not front and center. But if you're in Rwanda, you've got different questions on your plate every day about how you behave morally and so forth. And I think we're, this, to come back to the earlier points, we're a little indulged in the West because we've benefited so much from the stability of the Christian worldview and how it has shaped our capacity for freedom. And so it's an easy thing for us to say, live and let live and do whatever you'd like to do, but it just doesn't make sense in so many places around the world where you are actually faced with these decisions in a far more daily and confrontational manner.
And that's where we agree completely, that the society we live in, the liberal environment that we live in, has been the result of centuries and 1,500 years of Christian philosophy. We have no disagreement about that. But I don't think that we should be thankful by suddenly, you know, finding Christianity to be true. I don't think that that is the appropriate response, unless we personally believe that.
Yes, I think you can go back and think that through a little by saying, well, there's no reason to assume we would have got this world that we actually quite enjoy were it not for the Christian beliefs that shaped it. The Christian beliefs were not accidental to its happening. They were, in fact, formative beliefs. And if we had been, if a different worldview had taken over in the West, we would not be sitting here having this conversation so easily.
Well, not necessarily. We wouldn't be having the conversation in the exact same shape, but we could have been having a worse or better form of this conversation. And I don't think that recognising the Christian basis of our existing liberalism is to say that there wasn't a hypothetical alternative that could have even been better. I'm not sure. And the problem when you believe that there is a Christian truth that has directed these ideas through history is that, you know, first of all, it's unprovable.
Well, but except for human rights. I mean, you gave the kind of pathway.
I have many problems with the way we define human rights versus individual rights in the modern world as well. I think this is the concept of individual and human rights is a great thing. I don't think we would have them in their current shape if it was not for Christianity, but that doesn't mean I think there is a right to free housing, for example, which it has developed into.
Yeah,
it doesn't give you everything, and I'm still a liberal before I'm an atheist. Right. And I believe that the state should go away before I think God should go away. Me and God can juke it
out. God may have the same view.
Exactly.
Well, gentlemen, that might be a good note to sort of start to wrap up. We actually only have probably a few more minutes. So is there something still you'd like to share with the audience before I do close? Greg, I might give you first word and Chris can finish.
for me, I mean, goodness is tied up specifically with understanding who Jesus is and his revelation of God to us. Good is not really, a biblical concept. It's a more of a classical concept. For us, good means God who is loving, compassionate, doesn't keep a record of wrongs. All the definitional elements of God's character are what add up to goodness for a Christian. That is finally expressed in Jesus Christ, who comes to reveal God to us, to serve those around him, to teach us to love God and love neighbour, and ultimately to die on our behalf and show that actual true goodness is found in sacrifice. That's the shape of goodness for me as a Christian. And therefore, that leads to the attempt to emulate Christ and try to be good with God in that way.
Okay, thank you, Greg. And Chris?
And my slightly bellicose take is that Christianity is an accident of history. Your belief about the moral teaching of Jesus Christ is a result of non-religious forces. Without that, I think that there is no God and we are good without it. So I'm trying to find a moral framework whereby we have come to this position. And it is in that basic objective intuitiveness that we all share without needing to refer to any supernatural power.
Okay. Thank you, Chris. Well, please join me in thanking too.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.